Welcome back, Ham Radio listeners. This is Ham Radio Cooking with Amy Thielen. We are bringing you a little extra conversation. Not only did Amy join us on the KEXC Morning Show, I'm Heidi Holton, to talk cookies. Hope you didn't miss that episode. We also talked with another cookbook author. We kept Amy in the conversation so she could talk to a friend of hers, Hank Shaw. He's a Minnesota cookbook author. He's known for his website, Hunter Angler Gardener Cook, and his latest cookbook is out. It's called Borderlands, Recipes and Stories from the Rio Grande to the Pacific. Thanks so much for all your support in 2025 for Ham Radio. And again, stay tuned. We'll be bringing you another season of Ham Radio in 2026. You are tuned into the Thursday morning show. This is People Powered, KEXE. I'm Heidi Holton with Chelsea Perkins. Amy Thielen's going to stick around with us, and then we're talking with cookbook author Hank Shaw, and we got a ton of texts coming in, so we'll start that conversation with all the ideas about butter and the temperature of butter. Our thanks goes out to the Grand Rapids State Bank. They're committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And thanks to Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily 8 to 8, harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook.
And in the weather today, mostly cloudy with highs in the mid-teens, and there's a slight chance of snow and flurries this afternoon with a calm south wind. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. Lows 3 below 0 to 5 above.
And just to do a little sneak peek on Saturday night, because it's pretty extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. Saturday, we got mostly sunny and cold, chances of snow. Highs 2 below 0 to 9 below for the day. That's the high, with a blustery northwest wind, and evening lows 17 to 26 below zero.
It's going to be a good night to try new recipes, to maybe make your Christmas cookies. Our question of the week is about Christmas cookies. That's why we've invited our Ham Radio host, Amy Thielen, with us. And she's been answering lots of questions on it, including about the butter. And we welcome into the conversation now Hank Shaw. Hank has his 6th cookbook out. He's a former chef and journalist. He runs the James Beard award-winning website, Hunter Angler Gardener Cook, and his new book is Borderlands, Recipes and Stories from the Rio Grande to the Pacific. Welcome, Hank. And I hear, Amy, you and Hank already know each other.
Yes, we do.
Yes. It's been a minute, Amy. Was it Pheasant Fest?
Yeah, good to see you. It was Pheasant Fest.
Pheasant Fest.
That was really a really beautiful event. It was so much fun.
I can't even remember which year that was. What year was that?
Oh, gosh. Probably like 2017.
Before the pandemic.
17 or something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, so.
Yeah, but we've stayed in touch online a little bit, too. That's good.
Mm-hmm. So, Hank, we want to hear about your latest cookbook, but we've got to get to some of the listeners who have weighed in. So we've been talking Christmas cookies, and you can maybe fill us in if you are a Christmas cookie either eater or baker. But we talked about butter, and we had heard from a lot of folks. We had someone call who said, if your butter is too hard, use a cheese grater and grate it into the bowl, from Stephanie. Okay.
Yeah, we also hear from Jan and Dick that said the best hint they've had is to soften butter by standing it vertical on a plate and microwaving it for 7 to 9 seconds, flip it over and do it again. So I haven't tried that method. Maybe that's a good one too.
And then Amy, we've got a story coming in from Carol Ann. She says, 40 years ago, I was home from college for Christmas and I decided to make gingerbread house. My parents lived in Hammond, Louisiana, and it was warm and humid, usual December weather. I spent much of the day baking and constructing, with a call to my godmother in Virginia for advice. It looked great, and I had gingerbread people and trees in the yard of the house. The next morning, the humidity had done its job, and my creation looked like Salvador Dali gingerbread scene. Everything sagging and dripping. The figures were bowing, which gave it a worshipful vibe.
I love that story. That is so cool. So sweet.
And Vincent's listening this morning from Lafayette, Indiana. He says, butter, like thawing a turkey, it's about getting those center areas up to temperature. Can rush it without spoiling. Can't rush it. The interior microwave isn't uniform enough. It just has hot spots. So
can't rush it.
Yeah, there you go. Amy was telling us one of the secrets of a good sugar cookie, Hank, is good quality butter. And we were hearing the science of the butter, which is really pretty interesting.
All right.
So as always, our listeners know so much and add all the stories to this. Do you have any favorite Christmas cookies, Hank?
Nope. Don't really eat cookies.
Oh, okay. Well, let's...
Don't do it. Oh, wait. Okay. Have you ever made mincemeat?
Yes, I actually have made real mincemeat. Honest to God, mincemeat.
Tell us about that.
With ground venison and dried berries. It's old English, mincemeat really actually does have meat in it, or at least the old school does. And so I'm being as old school as I can be. I use ground venison and then dried currants and dried lingonberries and sometimes dried blueberries and a fair amount of brandy. And that mixture, I'm actually going to make that mixture this weekend for Christmas.
Wait, apples too, right? Do you put
apples? I don't do
apples.
Pear?
Oh, you don't do apples?
No,
oh, so you
I just
do mostly dried
berries.
Fruit. Oh, cool.
Yep. Yeah, straight up berries.
Very cool. This does sound like a really early kind of.
Yeah, it's like a 1600s recipe.
Oh, wow.
But it works really well.
This is why I love looking at your stuff and because you do so much historical, such a dive. You really do a lot of research. And I people around here are a lot of wild game hunters and hunters in general, and people often ask me for recipes, and I have a limited, I do some stuff with that, with venison, but I so often refer them to you. I'm like, go look at this website. You will find what you need.
Well, I appreciate that. That's really nice of you.
So Hank, you have some venison in one of the recipes in the new book, Borderlands, Recipes and Stories from the Rio Grande to the Pacific. I saw some venison taco.
Oh, yeah. I've got quite a lot of so that book, all my other books are sort of game forward and then you could substitute for store-bought meats. And this one's flipped. So the default would be like beef, chicken and pork. But I have tested all of them on game as well. So it's one of those deals where if you aren't a hunter, there's no big deal because those recipes are all geared towards so-called regular people. And but me being me, yes. And in fact, most of the photographs you see there that look like beef are, for the most part, actually venison.
Really? Because you have so much venison?
I mean, I shoot several deer a year, so yeah.
Where do you hunt?
I've done most of my deer hunting in Oklahoma because I run hunt camps down there with an outfitter, and the deer hunting there is it's a target rich environment, so it's not difficult to shoot. You know, your tag gets you three deer, so I don't need three deer, but I have a lot of friends who don't hunt who want venison, so I usually provide for them.
Does target rich mean a farm?
No, target rich means it's ag. So you're up in northern Minnesota.
So it's a lot
Yeah, it's not unlike hunting in, say, Rock County or southern Minnesota. It's
okay.
It's ag country, so there's more deer in there.
So, Hank, with this new book, like you said, you're kind of taking on a specific cuisine. When I first opened it, the first one I opened it to was the red chili rabbit, and that sounds very intriguing. We have some dogs that like to chase rabbits, and, you know, I think, gosh, if they do catch one, what can I do with it? And this might be it.
I mean, that's it's a really good recipe. And if I remember right, there is a Latin market in, I think it's in Brainerd. I can't remember. So I just moved to Minnesota for 3 years ago. So I'm still getting my geography right. And I always conflate Brainerd and Bemidji. I know that's a cardinal sin, but one of those two towns has a really good Latin market in it. Cause I was I served as a chef up in Reamer a couple of years ago in the fall. And so
that's a lot of cred right there.
Yeah.
Just want to say we're like big props there.
We had to get a whole bunch of ingredients, and I didn't bring everything from the cities. So we found the market, and it was actually quite good. So yes, you could make this red chili rabbit up there and with not a problem.
Yeah, I read that you said that you know, a lot of the things that can be for this book, which is about cooking along the southern border mm-hmm. of the U.S., can be sourced no matter where you are by looking up a Latin market in your area. And it's true. A new one just opened in Park Rapids that was just fantastic. And I mean, they have so much cool stuff and much better, more like a deeper well of like really Latin ingredient, you know, ingredients from a lot of South America, Central America. Really cool.
Yeah, you're starting to see that a lot where it's not just Mexican anymore. You're seeing Guatemala and El Salvador and Colombia and places like that.
If you were going to recommend someone, you know, that's not familiar with this style of cooking, like what are some good recipes to start with to kind of just get into the groove of cooking this way?
Let's see. I mean, the whole beginning of the book is basics and you know, bedrock stuff like making beans and then learning how to make those beans into refried beans, learning how to make the Mexican rice that is on most plates, salsas, basic salsas like pico de gallo and just a typical blended salsa like salsa verde or salsa roja and stuff like that. Those are your building blocks. And then, you know, if you go to Mexico, everybody's judged on that. So it's very much like France where sure, your meat could be good, but if your sauce is terrible, everyone's going to be like, you know? And so it's getting good at the salsas, is a really good first step.
Tell us the kind of inspiration for you to put this new cookbook together.
Well, I've been in and around the Mexican border for the last 25 years, quite a lot. And on both sides, and you know, I can speak Spanish, so I can get my way around on both sides as well. And the area there is so unbelievably beautiful, and the people there are so unbelievably friendly. And I was really struck by the duality of everyone there. So if you live in and around the border, you're neither fully Mexican nor are you fully American. You're a fronterizo, and they're. Their language is a seamless blend of, so you think about Spanglish in your head, and it's a little bit like that, but it's they do it so artfully. It's just kind of amazing just to kind of live in that two worlds all at the same time. And the food is actually much more simple than you might think. A lot of the Mexican food that is very popular right now is from Oaxaca or Mexico City or Yucatan, and that's all really pretty complicated. The stuff in the north is much simpler and much more straightforward. In many ways, it's the Midwest of Mexico.
Makes sense. I love this idea of a borderland cuisine. I've always found just even like I used to work for a chef who was from like the Dolomites of Europe, where it's like Italy meets Austria. And like, I just found that place where those cultures collide can be such a rich place of creativity. Were there any dishes that you thought were really, you know, exemplified that coming together?
I mean, there's a lot. So on the American side, things like green chili grits are a really good one. And in New Mexico, now New Mexico is the Louisiana of the West, like it's its own thing. New Mexico is not Arizona. It's not Coahuila. It's not Chihuahua. It's its own thing. So
how would you say, like, what is it like to you?
So it has an enormous amount of indigenous influence in its cooking. And so the enchilada sauce in Mexico is not going to have any flour in it. But in New Mexico, it starts with a root. So there's this old Spanish influence in that particular enchilada sauce. And what's really cool about it is it sets up really nice. And it's this kind of amalgam of Western European sort of Spaniard and then indigenous plus Mexican. And it's that state in and of itself. There are whole books written about New Mexico food and I just kind of skim the surface, but that's a really good example. And green chili grits is like a pretty normal breakfast food in West Texas and in Arizona and New Mexico. there is the idea of chili. So chili is probably the thing that really is the most resonant, because everybody here, everybody listening has eaten chili, and chili morphs depending on where you're from. And the Texans will tell you that they invented chili, but they actually didn't. I mean, maybe they did when Texas was actually part of Mexico, but there are this constellation of chili-like dishes that exist on both sides of the border. So in New Mexico, it would be chili Colorado. In Texas, it's chili. And there's a whole bunch of, there's guisado de abejeo, which is which means cattle rustler's stew. There's another one called, and we probably can't say this on the air, so get ready. It's called son of a bitch stew. And it's a cowboy dish. But then there's another one called caldillo de carne seca, which is like a beef jerky stew, but it's really chili. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So like there's,
tell me more about that. Sorry.
Oh, it's awesome. So imagine chili, but the meat is carne seca, is beef jerky. So it's chopped up into pieces that you can eat with a spoon, and then stewed with tomatoes and lots of chilies and cumin and Mexican oregano and sometimes beans, sometimes not. And it's a thing that you could do when you're on the range in the middle of the desert running cattle, because almost everything that is in that dish is dried, so that you can then just add water essentially and make this amazing stew. But that red, thick, meaty, chili-like dish, that's the universal along the border.
I'm going to make that for our next camping trip for sure.
You totally could.
Wow. Hank, I wonder if you talk a little bit about to us something that's coming up that you're going to be demonstrating some of your recipes at. I do not know what this is. It's called Forest Fair.
Yes. So the Forest Fair is down in Chaska, in the southwest suburbs of the Twin Cities. And it's a maker's fair. It's like, it's all people, like little small businesses and people who make pottery and, you know, soaps and sell dried mushrooms and other dried forest products and stuff like that. And it's held at the Mustard Seed Garden Center. So it's like a big garden center in Chaska. And the thing that I'm doing is I'm demonstrating a dish from the book that can be easily done with Minnesota ingredients. So I'm looking out at my office now, and we have a foot of snow on the ground. So there's no greens to be gathered right now, but I gathered some lamb's quarters in the summertime and blanched and froze them, tons of mushrooms. And then the secret ingredient to this dish is chili pasilla, which is this unique thing that's only kind of in northern Mexico and in New Mexico as well, where you take like a poblano or a green hatch chili and you roast it and you peel it, but then you dry it. So it's the only dried roasted green chili that exists in the world, really. And it's unique to that region. You can use fresh roasted green chilies too if you wanted. But this chili pasilla is, you know, again, it's like it's this sort of, we live in a desert. There's no refrigeration. Everything is dry. So there's this thread that goes on through there. And it's you cook all these together with some onion and garlic and a little bit of chili, and then you serve it on tacos, and it's really good.
So how has moving to Minnesota and the North changed, or has it changed anything about your cooking practice? Like, I'm wondering if you've, you know, gotten like a snowshoe hare or anything that's real particular to hear.
Oh, I mean, I lived here 20 years ago, so I think I've hunted and fished pretty much every species that you can in Minnesota. But I think the biggest thing that's changed, and one of the reasons I actually moved here, is that foot of snow that's sitting outside my office right now, is because I used to live in Sacramento, California, and everything happens there all at once. So you've got every week there's something fresh, seasonal, and local. And here, you really have to think about eating really well in February, in April, May, and June, and July. So the idea of it sharpens the mind that things end here. There is a six-month period where nothing really grows. So you have to be very good at drying or fermenting or pickling or, yes, freezing, but there's lots of things that you have to think ahead. And then we're all in such a frenzy. Everybody warned me about when I moved here about, you know, the seasonal frenzy and the seasonal disorders that everyone gets. And I was thinking it would be now, but it really isn't. It's June, because June, everybody has massive FOMO and is like doing everything everywhere all at once. It's like, I have a friend who like goes rollerblading at like 9:45 p.m. and then June, and it was like, what are we doing here? Because it's just like the summer's just like blah. And the reverse of that right now is moderation. It's quiet. Like we go to bed early, we do fewer things, and we're okay with that. I really like that rhythm, where there was a certain sameness about Sacramento that I needed to get away from.
That makes so much sense. I mean, I think it's August is just like a frenzy, because people, I mean, Chelsea's nodding, right? Isn't it crazy?
Oh, because yeah. And just trying to put up all the food and everything too, if you have a garden, and that's when things really start to rock and roll.
Tomatoes and peppers.
And then people, mm-hmm. And then people are like, oh, come on this weekend, last thing of summer. And you're like, I'm chained in my kitchen. Heidi, are you going to talk about skating, about roller skating?
Oh, no, I am not.
Yes, you're sure.
No, okay. I'm not. No.
She's been known to do that. But yeah, I think that also, you know, in your garden, when you have all those apples, your orchard, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a crazy time. People are just.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're making syrup. You're dealing with all that.
Right.
What did you do with all those apples this year?
Cider. We made a lot of cider. And then we freeze it. Tom even makes it into popsicles, which is the best thing ever. Just to grab at night, you know, when it gets a little too warm by the wood stove. You just need a little bit of refreshment. and then we gave a lot away. I mean, it's also the time of year where you get pretty generous too about things if you've had some good crops, and people reciprocate. You know, they maybe didn't have apples, but they have this, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. People want to participate, so that's.
I've heard about the ring and run zucchini drops on people's front door.
not just doors, right? Cars, watch out for your car or truck bed. You're gonna find zucchini, that's for sure.
Yep, in the mailbox, wherever it'll fit.
Yeah, Amy, was there anything out of your garden that was just a little too much this year, and you had to figure out how to deal with it? Or it was everything.
It was kind of a perfect year. I have a lot of potatoes, and we had a lot of carrots. And, you know, we dig the carrots. The carrots were great this year. We dig them. We scrub them. And then we air dry them on towels, on sheet trays for 2 days so that they're really dry. And then when I put them in plastic bags and into my refrigerator, because I don't have a root cellar. You know, they stay for a long time, but they have to be dry. And actually that, you know, scrubbing carrots is kind of a pain.
I got a fun trick for you.
Yo, tell me.
So get yourself a wooden box, you know, like a, you know, a decent crate. That's the hardest part of this whole thing. Then go to a pet store or a play store or some toy store and get a bunch of like, you know, not dirty sand and clean sand. And then don't even wash them. Just take them out of the ground and bury them in the sand and put them in your basement, and they'll keep for 6 months.
But if your basement's heated,
doesn't matter, because your basement's still cooler. Is your basement still going to be cooler than the rest of your house? Even if it's 60 degrees, it'll last for 6 months.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you have a non-heated part of your basement? Because I've got a heated and a non-heated.
Sort of. I'm in the basement right now, but I have an unfinished basement. That's very Minnesotan. Yes.
Hank, I will back you up on that. We do that with our carrots, you know, keep them in the ground long so they're sweet. They get a little frost mm-hmm. on them, and then we put them right in this bucket of sand and mm-hmm. enjoy them through the winter, and they're very good. Oh, I hate
no scrubbing.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but we have run out of time. Hank's new book is out. It's called Borderlands, Recipes and Stories from the Rio Grande to the Pacific. Hank Shaw, thank you so much for being with us today. You can check out his award-winning website, Hunter Angler Gardener Cook, and Amy Thielen, our host of Ham Radio. Good to have you back, and more Ham Radio to come in 2026.
Yes. Congratulations on this book. I love it.
Thank you. Great. Thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks, Hank.